With the election well and truly underway, we look at runners and riders. With that SNP video, is the party finally moving to talk about the destination of independence rather than constantly hugging all the problems created by the union towards it? With his idea of a community of the realm and a declaration of Ellen, is Alex Salmond's Alaba Party moving forward with something other independence voters can really embrace? What about the Tories? What about the Tories? The Hard Man Act that Douglas Ross is putting on, is that actually pushing people away because it's so far from the Scottish consensus? And Anas Sarwar, is he able to come up with a new, different version of what unionism might look like? Will he even be asked? Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, chums, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. And thanks very much for you got in touch and saying how much they like the new mellow sound of my microphone setup. It's almost when I listen back to it myself, I always felt it should be saying, hi there and welcome to Cool FM. It's 1 a.m. and we're now going to slip in some, if I may put it this way, Frank and Nancy Sinatra. You know, that's the way it sounded. It didn't sound like me at all. So, and I do have a bit of the throaty thing going on with this time of year as well. So, yes, I could make an absolute fortune doing adverts for B&Q and stuff like that. But hi, yeah. Oh, where do we begin again? Yes, we're in the midst of election fever. We can start with the, I think, possibly, because it leads into a whole lot of things we're going to be talking about, the leaders' debate, who was there, who wasn't there, what was said, and what wasn't said, Leslie, because you and I think are on the same page exactly about this, what wasn't talked about, and apparently it's a policy void area right across the current election campaign. Mm.
Well, and it's independence. I mean, I wrote a piece about mm-hmm. this for the Herald, but I appreciate this is now that a bit's behind a paywall, so I appreciate a lot of people will not actually see the column ever for the Herald, but I mean, what began to strike me, I mean, there's obvious things you could say about the leaders' debate, you know, the three times kind of question, yeah. The lack of balance, blah, blah. But what began to become, you know, as I thought about it a bit later, what really is missing completely from every kind of discussion is actually discussing independence, the destination, as opposed to the journey towards it, viz. The NDRF. Now, these are two very different things. And everybody, and that sort of actually even includes ALBA, everybody's discussing how to get there potentially. And that's where all the kind of arguments arising. Never mind that actually what we're trying to go for is a kind of vision-free zone. You know, nobody's actually saying, look, here in this different country is what we could actually be doing with independence. And it's the thing that's relevant all the time. I mean, I know I bang on about this all the time, but we could be setting up our different energy system. We would be deciding if we wanted to have a nationalised, nationally owned energy company, or whether we're going to continue with the big six who just keep accidentally mis-selling stuff to people all the time and overpricing electricity such that we have people dying still of hypothermia here, whereas the Arctic Nordic countries dinner. You know, there's all sorts of stuff you can do once you take the template of Britishness out of how we manage our lives. There's so many things that we could look at doing. Quite obviously, people's minds jump to things like defence. You can kind of keep your extra 45% Trident, you know, missiles or put them somewhere else. But, you know, then there's the EU and EEA. There's the question of trade, whether we join the EU or don't. And all of that sits in a world where you have control over all the choices you make. I was very struck when I did the film about Estonia, about how the first thing they were able to do when they were independent, and I mean, the first thing, let's say, after they bounced back from a really difficult time when they went cold turkey and had no contracts with Russia, no trade with their former trading, 100% trading partner, and were brave enough to kind of go and cold turkey almost and sort of pivot to a new market, which was the rest of Europe. One of the first things they were able to do was change their education system around to really mimic the very successful Finnish model. There they are now, 20, 30 years later, at the top of the PISA charts. teaching other people how to do it. That used to be our spot. So it's not just that there's things that you could do, because the Estonians controlled a lot of education, just like Scotland does. But they weren't kind of free enough to be able to embark on a completely different direction for things. You need to have some time to get the old defaults, presumptions, and actually the administrators of those things out of your system to be able to move towards new things. And that debate, you know, that business of looking ahead is never done. It's only ever couched in terms of there will be disaster, there will be problems with your currency, there will be this, there will be that. But the independent side of the argument never goes, well, you know, there could be some difficulties, but actually, I think we'll probably handle whatever comes, because here's a big reveal: every independent country has. Meanwhile, back at the fort, here's the other things that sit in that paddock. You know, it's not just a kind of paddock of peril. It's not just somewhere where there's only problems, risk and danger. There's the incredible risk that we could actually create something special, because that's what pretty much every independent country has done in their various ways. Now, God, you know, I appreciate it's very hard to open up a subject line that the interviewer and the whole construct of the debate is not allowing you to move into. And that's my real beef with the BBC and STV and the whole, anybody who's walking in this terrain. The debate that Scots need to hear is the COVID recovery and the green transition, the union or independence, which is better for Scotland? Because that's Absolutely. The bit we're all having to do ourselves, is take a piece from this thing, a piece from that thing. You know, we want a really, in that respect, a square go, where people look at, you know, every politician or political leader is forced to work through a scenario, a strategy with planning, rather than just these episodic bursts of personality bashing and kind of defensive posturing, which passes for political debate. It is pathetic. And I'm actually, when you think of the kind of stuff that Scotland will soon, once we become independent, have to be thinking, and the level of debate we need to be reaching, this is just nowhere near it, you know. So anyway, that was
yes,
that was the tilt, basically.
Well, yeah, because the thing I was thinking, because when I watched the debate and the contingent process, is that the SNP is a very broad church. We've spoken about this, and people who've been listening to the podcast over a number of years realise that we've been highly critical of the Scottish government, the SNP government, not utilising the powers it currently has, for example, in things like land ownership and reform of local authorities and all these other things they could be doing, they haven't done. But do you think why the SNP is not talking about this, Lizzie? Do you think it's because it's too broad a church currently? It's too having to keep everybody on side and moving in one direction? And that's a genuine question. Is that the SNP saying to itself, we cannot put forward these very definite, and when I say radical, I don't mean it in a left-wing sense. I mean looking at the root of problems and the root of issues. For example, when the First Minister was responding to questions on the attainment gap, I was shouting out the television screen, yes, there is an attainment gap between the better off and the less well off. And the way you tackle that is fundamentally start off with tackling the poverty gap. Mm. The ridiculous gap in wealth and income and an access that exists in this country that we cannot tackle properly because we're tied to a Westminster system and we're tied to the United Kingdom. And yes, there are other factors involved in that, such as the con trick that's been played on mainly on working class young men, that somehow being interested in things that are intellectual emasculates you and posh, you know. But let's take it. Let's tackle poverty. How are we going to do that? Because the rest of it, you're absolutely right, are piecemeal bits of policy. We're going to build X number of social housing. We're going to give laptops here. We're going to do wee bits here and there. It's mitigation rather than you saying, here's the big picture. But is there genuinely a big picture within the Scottish National Party that they could actually put out there? Is there one?
Well, I honestly don't know. I mean, in the last 5 years, there hasn't been a debate about independence within the SNP conference, except accidentally via the attempt to sort of endorse the Growth Commission report. Mm-hmm. So you do wonder, and for sure the number of times. I mean, now I've noticed. I think I wrote an article about this, about something exactly about this, about that education is so umbilically linked to inequality.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what kind of, you know, Finland's all the places that have tackled stuff have put equity at the heart of their policy on everything. And then it helps educational outcome, big style, because it allows cohorts to be set up. I mean, my stepdaughter lives in the Netherlands, and we were talking about this, and she says, you know, the school that her friend teaches at has got a complete mixture of kind of bairns in the classroom. Their parents do all sorts of different things, covering an entire class gamut. This is partly because there isn't the old class private school thing sitting underpinning stuff, but that's also because the school system is extremely good, so it's unnecessary. And that's really what most of the Nordic countries' big secret is, is that they have kept public services high standard, so that affluent people buy into them, pay their taxes, don't grudge it. Of course they grudge it some, and some of the politics that's changing in those countries suggests that there is some restiveness about that, that the virus that is born in Britain could well be beginning to transplant to other countries, where you think there's a shortcut. Mm-hmm. You can have everything and have the society you've got, but actually keep more of your money for yourself. Well, you know, we're the proof that that doesn't happen. But I never hear that critique coming from anybody in the SNP. I think it's a kind of combination of things, but I think it is the extreme wariness that Nicola has to embarking on things where she is not completely briefed and in control. Mm-hmm. And that there is not yet a kind of complete move into the independence mode. We're sitting on the edge of it. So until we get somewhere near what she thinks is the go mark, we're not going to hear a squeak about, you know, the terrain beyond the election. First of all, she takes things absolutely one at a time. And I think that's, you know, that has got her through the night so far, but it gets you so far and no further, because I don't think people suspend their judgment on issues until, you know, the big people are ready to kind of weigh in with their theories and kind of their perspectives. People are making their minds up right now on the basis of lots of stuff, which is not worthy of being considered in this big discussion. Mm-hmm. So it really drives me crazy that we're not able to have this. I mean, I see this morning, just briefly look at one of the papers, one of the big SNP pushes today is to have more free breakfast and lunch or whatever, something I should have looked more carefully. But, you know, there's more basic free food being provided at schools for kind of poor kids.
Yeah.
Well, there you are again. You know, that is the sticking plaster. And you could say that being brought up in the Scottish government and devolved setup, and I'm not meaning she was brought up, I mean, she's not that young, Urla Nicola, but I mean that her political life has been spent in the Scottish setup, is a setup of mitigation, you know. So it's very possible that that becomes just such an automatic default that you kind of feel a bit, it's almost cowed by having to get into the bigger stuff. I notice this quite often that, gosh, there's not much that American politicians can ever do to sort of inspire you particularly, but they will very quickly move into the big picture very quickly on all sides and start, you know, have you need to have the skills to be able to set that vision up. And I don't know what the problem is here that we can't seem to get that. You know, some people have reduced it to, okay, Boris had a good slogan, get Brexit done. But that was because it was suggesting a sort of vision. It was a kind of, we'll all be better when we're mm-hmm. sailing along on our own, and, you know, it's Great Britain and all that sort of stuff. You know, it needs a similar sense of vision. I'm not calling for more slogans. Slogans are derived, when it works properly, from a vision that can be spelled out really easily by everyone who comes to the mic. And the other thing is, only Nicola ever comes to the mic. You know, actually, Mike mm-hmm. Russell got there a few times on independence, but nobody else does. So if she's the one who feels that she'll never embark on that journey till she's got the whole thing pinned down, then we're not going to hear too much colour about what independence could look like. And I just think that's a shame.
Yeah, because I mean, I don't know if I'm entirely incorrect here, but I do get the sense that Nicola Sturgeon's political ideology is left of centre. I mean, everything she says, her background and her statement about getting into politics because of Thatcher and her opposition to nuclear weapons and everything, it strongly suggests to me there is a core of left of centre social democracy in there. But I generally think there's a difficulty there because of the concept of the broad church taking everybody with us and the managerialism that's actually been the hallmark of the SNP in government. And it has mitigated. God knows it has. But we've got to go beyond mitigation. I entirely agree with you. And leading us into, you would have hoped...
But it's the other wee thing, mm-hmm. just to say, Pat, is that mm-hmm. I think she also has a sort of thing where she doesn't want to keep blaming London for stuff because yeah. in doing so, mm-hmm. although it's completely accurate a lot of the time, it does also make you into a victim. You know, I think her whole thing is to try to get Scotland to stand on its own feet, and showing that it can stand on its own feet, then you encourage people to think, "Ching, you know, actually we're making a fair fist of this. If we just had more powers, we'd be, mm-hmm. you know, we'd be doing away." And kind of every time you sort of blame a problem on somebody else, you lose your agency in it. So yeah. that's true. And I'm kind of probably a big believer in that. I try to not blame anybody or anything for stuff that happens to me in life. But actually, sometimes it really wasn't my fault. Sometimes there is a larger world out there. And I think that's another thing with her, that she's got so used to not doing the sort of baiting Westminster thing, which actually many sort of Swithering voters used to actually get a bit fed up with Alex Salmond was a bit the opposite. And I'm sure that when you work in a team, you often become quite complimentary. So one tends to be the kind of one that has a pop over the border and constantly is kind of highlighting how Westminster is kind of fixing the game. The other one tends to compensate for that. Mm-hmm. And actually, she is now sitting, in fact, both of them are sitting without compensatory influences in their lives. So for Nicola, that does mean that she will just so rarely take a pop, you know, at Westminster. It's quite extraordinary how it's sitting it's sitting there. I mean, even within the context of Brexit, it sometimes you felt it really took something for her to actually say, "We are being stuffed here." Yeah. It was often Mike Russell that had to come out and actually sound really angry about it. So she's not going to do anger. She's not going to do blaming. She's going to do, "We can actually run stuff here," and she's going to hug to her, therefore, problems she can't fix.
Yeah.
You know, problems devolution can't fix, because now there's a total reluctance to sort of begin to weed out where the structural problems lie. And I think also she's wary of over-promising, because obviously the suggestion that Westminster is to blame for many things suggests that once Westminster's taken out of the equation, it's all hunky-dory. And there's another thing that's obviously, you know, there will be a tough time adjusting to stuff, and we'll have to start having debates about what we want to do. We're going to have to talk about taxation and many things that have sort of been conveniently stuck in the corner, so we can virtue signal very easily here because we're not sitting with all the powers. Well, glory be the day it all comes back here. We're going to have these conversations that we really haven't had properly. So I think there's a wariness too about sort of getting everybody's feelings up on the yes side. That, and with one bound, they are free. There'll have to be a lot of work done, you know. So I think all of that also sits behind this reluctance. Anyway, on you go.
Yeah, because that actually leads me down another route here, which was I watched the SNP election broadcast last night, and that certainly took a different tack. I mean, it was interestingly staged. It looked like a multimedia theatrical experience at the Scottish National Theatre. It was very slickly done, but that very definitely laid the blame at Westminster, and neatly, through the use of the video, laid the blame squarely on Boris Johnson and what was coming down the line towards us. As someone has said to me, a very dystopian perspective on Westminster, then finishing up with, and these are the the things we could do, we could actually progress towards an independent Scotland, and but focusing on emotions rather than hard policy. So I just wonder if there's a, is it just the election bringing this out? But I mean, I thought that was a different tack from what you've, I agree entirely with you on that perspective, even just about hugging the problems to ourselves and not wanting to point the finger at Westminster. So it might signal a wee change there. Mm-hmm. But
I didn't actually see that. I noticed that and sort of thought to self, watch that later. And of course, later never came.
Yeah.
And it's very possible that, ALBA has actually changed much of this because it's putting a lot of heat on. So it means that actually there is a churn within the independence vote between the parties. I mean, they are rivals on the list. Mm-hmm. So, you've got to kind of up your kind of independence quotient if you're going to be keeping your own folk on board and they're not going to drift across to ALBA on the list.
Yeah, and we still wait for, we waited to Thursday because we thought we were going to get detailed policy commitments. And again, it still goes back to, I noticed the National picked up on, if you actually, what we said last week, which was, if you actually want to get kind of a drift, what might be ALBA's policies, take a look at the Alex Salmond and,
Alex
Neil. I couldn't remember his first name. Oh, I nearly said Michael O'Neill, which is, it's an entirely different person who's a football manager. But Alex Neil's paper that they produced last year. So again, what a Social Democratic Party committed to a fair Scotland, which is environmentally, sound. I mean, that's all we've got so far. From that framework, but interesting people again with Kerevin and Berry in there, and we'll see what comes out of that. What's come out of it for me, to be perfectly honest, is I want people to make an informed decision on how they're going to use their list vote. That's it for me. And just think about it. I mean, I sound like the Queen before the referendum, don't I? Just to think about the future there, folks, and just consider what you're going to be doing with your list vote. But people are now talking about it, I think, in a much more informed way. And Douglas Ross, that seems to be the thrust of the Tories as well, looking at their election material that popped through the door to me, which is, mentioned independence far more than any independent supporting party has done over a number of years, and is absolutely explicit, as was Ross this morning, both on Good Morning Scotland, where he was referred to by Laura Maxwell in an introduction as Douglas Murray. Even she didn't get his name right. And, I swear it. I thought, oh boy, yeah. And on Corky as well.
There's a few wee muddly bits there, where she was quite terse with him, but she just got some things wrong. I mean, he voted Remain, she said you voted for Brexit. So there's just wee bits in there where, there's parts of the drive missing. But I mean, her general point was, look what's happening in Northern Ireland at the moment.
Absolutely.
Much of this fueled by the problem with the protocol and, the predictability of what was happening, but, other things at work as well. So, I mean, that was a pretty sort of, it was actually very awkward listening because it was he just talked absolute rubbish. But just to step back one, I mean, I watched the ALBA policy launch. That wasn't really a policy launch because, it was clever enough, actually, because it was much, much better than, obviously, than the launch, which had so many technical problems. There were no technical problems. And it also used the fact that so many media would be present. And really, the questions came from absolutely all the front political correspondents of every newspaper. They've got everyone's attention now within the media. And they used it to actually profile some of their leading female candidates.
Yes.
Who did little speeches at the start, which was clever as well, because it meant everyone was going to wait and watch through that to get to the meal, the main thing, which was Alex Salmond. So they did all that. And, Alex sort of came on and said, policy, well, actually, we'll be deciding more of that at a kind of meeting to be held soon. And the first ones they're going to tackle are education, the COVID recovery. There's another that I've got too many bits of paper here. But I mean, not the big ones that people, I think, had perhaps been expecting at that event, which might be the direction on the EU versus the halfway house as a future for Scotland. Or the one that I kind of expected, given that that Alex is an energy economist, he does have interesting ideas about energy. I'd love to hear them. So that's sort of down the line. This was about independent strategy. And actually listening to him was quite extraordinary, because there's a bit of you sort of drifts back off to when this used to be your normal, you know, when he mm-hmm. was First Minister and SNP leader. And he started to kind of weave a narrative out of significant dates. So this, of course, was an event being held on the 701st anniversary of the Declaration of Arbroath. What was that declaration? He was interpreting it as a statement of the kind of community of the realm about its desires for Scotland. And here he was launching a declaration of Ellen, because that's where he was speaking from in Aberdeenshire, to do the same thing now as regards independence. And then I started thinking, well, and of course, the film that was being overlaid, as you heard some of this stuff at the beginning, there was big overlays of, you know, statues of Robert the Bruce, panning up a statue of Robert the Bruce in great detail. We're getting this, Robert the Bruce, right? We've mm-hmm. got this, and we've got the date. We get the significance. We get this is now an historic reenactment happening, which just, I don't know. You know, I've made a blooming film about the Declaration of Arbroath, and to be absolutely fair to Alex, you know, he actually shared it really widely and said it was a brilliant film and urged everyone to watch it. In contrast to other leaders I approached who didn't, so we just say. So, you know, he's in there. He believes this, you know, he's interested in this aspect of political history. But it does clothe it in a kind of narrative, which you might just begin to become mm-hmm. a bit restive about. And then went on to sort of devise a sort of scenario, which then began to just remind me of all the ones past that we've been through, you know, the kind of scenarios, well, starting by Free by 93, the scenarios about the shared currency that was one he kind of yeah. dreamt up essentially on his own, as far as I understand it, without a cabinet discussion. And then everybody was saddled with having to try and defend, to try to create the narrative, which semi-happened, that, you know, George Osborne was going to shut us out of using our currency. And of course, that did harden independence support. Folk who were already on board were blooming hyper on board as soon as George Osborne starts telling you what you can and can't do. But actually, it scared the bejesus out of everybody mm-hmm. else, you know. So, I mean, there's no doubt that Alex is an absolute past master at sort of taking sundry bits and bobs. I mean, the Ark of Prosperity comes to mind as well. You know, that was a kind mm-hmm. of crafting of saying, look at just immediately what's around us, these plucky little neighbours with independence and levers to do stuff we can't. And of course, the Ark of Prosperity promptly collapsed practically the year, 2 years after he, mm-hmm. he created it, essentially. Partly because Ireland and Iceland are actually quite capitalist economies with much of the same inequality that Scotland has bolted into their systems. Norway different. You know, Norway has had no economic collapse, but that's because it really is a very equal society and has sorted an awful lot of stuff out. So this is not to decry Ireland and Iceland. They have bounced back, but, you know, I'll put good money on them bouncing down at some point as mm-hmm. well. Because they're not getting to grips with a lot of what causes this stop-start in their economies and their societies. What you could have rightly described them as is an arc of resilience, because whatever happens to them, they bounce back. And they're also at the top of the happiness index, you know, just while we're at it. So, you know, but the point of all of this was the Arc of Prosperity was a good conceit. You know, it was a good narrative. It was a good gimmick, if you like. And then it went pear-shaped, and it actually brought the argument, because it was too hard to go, but, you know, it brought the whole argument about prosperity of neighbours right down the pan for a couple of years at least, where it was described as the arc of insolvency by mm-hmm. the opposition. So this is my beef really with Alex, which is, I totally get that you do. I mean, there's me starting off saying that you need this larger vision, and certainly using parable and narratives. I mean, it's almost biblical sometimes, these kind of parable type scenarios that Alex sets out. But if they're too far adrift, you know, if they're too floaty and too embedded in sort of almost sentiment rather than grounded in some sort of reality, even though that might be boring. I mean, look at Free by 93. It was never going to be Free by 94, was it? You know, you get the sense that things are constructed for their sound sometimes.
Yes, in reverse order.
You know, just rather than how they actually might be delivered. And this is, I think, what worries people, because you need to be in this, obviously, for the long haul, so that the vision you give that will be good for the next year or so has got to be one that doesn't fall off the edge of a cliff a year later. And that might be boring. It'll be a lot less colourful. But it does mean that you're kind of keeping faith with people who don't want to be up and down. And you're keeping faith with the folk at the back of the queue who are just not as confident as you are that everything can so easily be done. And I mean, I'll quite say that. I wrote a piece in The National today, and I'm not sure I quite got this right, but you need a starter. You know, you need somebody who's confident enough to take everybody across the road when they see a gap in the traffic. But the trouble is, you might have folk at the back who just don't feel confident that that gap in the traffic works for them.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be conscious that you've got to keep coming back across the road to take people over when they feel it's okay, not just that you feel everything's possible and doable. And that's, again, what sort of worries me a little bit, is that this is the kind of cockiness that annoyed a lot of people about Alex. You know, confidence is great, but cockiness, just, it's so close in the spectrum, but it just turns a little corner that just annoys people, or just makes them worried that if there was really a problem out there, would he ever tell us? You know, would we ever know if there was a not sunny upland up there? And people need to be dealt with reasonably seriously now. I mean, I know everybody doesn't want to have the full blasted detail of every problem we might face becoming independent, because you possibly, you know, it's like everything in life. If you knew all the trauma that would just be associated with being a parent, that none of us would exist, right?
Yeah.
So there's some stuff you don't want to know too much about. I'll get that. But it can't all be always sunny on our side of the fence, because people know that's not life. So I think this sort of certainty that Alex has, which is his great strength, and his kind of cockiness that comes with his sort of leadership offer, is also very attached to what people feel uneasy about. And I've got to say, I, after listening to that whole long kind of offer on Tuesday, the strategy offer, I was both quite sort of, I was quite uplifted by it, because it sounded like a good scenario. And then this niggling thing kind of crept back in again, which just left me feeling, I just wanted a policy launch, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the tragedy, Leslie, that you've identified, is the fact that we actually had salmon and sturgeon. We actually had that. You know, that was a combination that worked, like Ferguson and Archie Knox, or Jim McLean, Walter Smith. You know, that's what you require. You need that blend. Peter Taylor, Brian Clough, and we're on about football, and this will be over the heads of a lot of people who are totally
kind of
not interested.
Going on here, but anyway.
It's football.
Morecambe and Wise, no.
Yeah, Morecambe and Wise. Well, yeah, Eric and Ernie, good. Yeah, but you do require that balance, where two people who respect each other, listen to each other, and balance each other out. And that's what is definitely required, because what you get from Alex Salmond, from what I've identified, is a highly intelligent, quick-minded pick-and-mix man. You know, we'll pick that bit from there, we'll pick this bit from here, without looking at what actually underpins all these good bits, particularly in countries like Norway, is an equitable, socially democratic country where there's a broad spectrum of agreement about the fundamentals of how their society should run across the political spectrum. It's a different setup. They have actually resolved the issues that you've clearly identified in your writing. They resolved many of the issues and continue to work to resolve them. But that's why the good bits work.
Mm-hmm. And this kind of low-hanging fruit collection is a real curse, actually, of Scottish politics, because, you know, people, even though they may not be absolute expert about, let's say, Norwegian or Nordic politics, they just sense that you can't, any more than Thatcher did. You know, Thatcher went and got very excited about Japan, no recognition of unions. You know, so she came back with this, whoa, this is the model for us. And of course, you know, it may work in Japan. That's questionable. They did go through a very long period of complete stagnation economically. But, you know, she brought one aspect of that back, heralded it as being part of the Japanese miracle. And, you know, the rest is history. So the transplanting of one thing is always a difficult one. And yet that's as good as we seem to get. Do we ever get to, you know, just what most people actually intuitively know, which is an equal society is better for everyone? I just would love to hear one of them say that and sound like they meant it, because unless you really start to move into this, and this is what Gordon Brown also didn't do. You know, Gordon's was famous for his stealth taxes, which fine, you know, at the end of it, you can do the maths. And actually, there had been redistribution under his governance, which completely disappeared as soon as the Tories took over. But the trouble was that the argument wasn't had and won in public. It was a stealth tax. So the arguments for redistribution were being had in private. So once you know, come to an election and you've actually got to try and make the arguments, you're always on the back foot because you haven't been working this through. Like, I was out in the garden this morning trying to work through some sort of, you know, high quality fertilizing manure stuff to kind of help the garden. You got to, it's blooming backbreaker, but you got to work it through because otherwise it doesn't reach the roots. So the thing is, you know, we've not reached the, and I mean, I wouldn't want to have to try and reach the roots of the British, the English voting public either, you know, because that's a complicated game. Thankfully, it's not one we have to get into too much here. But as far as Scotland's concerned, you have to start trying to reach the roots of problems, because we'll soon be in a position where we're asking people to think about larger things than just mitigation, you know. So anyway, we're sort of banging on too much. But the other thing that came out today, I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this, is all these opinion polls. I mean, every day there's a different opinion poll.
Not today's opinion poll, isn't it? No.
Well, there's one that's the Scotsman, a Savanta poll that the Scotsman has done, who are somewhat cock-a-hoop at that basically it robs ALBA, basically the SNP of its sort of working majority. So the current projection is that the SNP would get 63-65 is what you need to have a sort of working majority. And so that, of course, is the kind of nightmare solution scenario. I mean, overall, they come up with about 73 MSPs being independents, the supermajority, if you want, because there are more Greens elected. But if it matters, you know, if it matters to the conduct of, well, the threshold that's in everybody's minds and what represents success and winning in this weird semi sort of Westminster-y semi-proportional system that we have, then that doesn't happen under this poll. But to be fair, you know, the last poll was kind of, what was it, 2 days ago, was quite the opposite and suggested actually that the SNP would both get a working majority and there would be a super majority, you know, of ND MSPs. So it kind of seems you take your company, you take your pick, and things roll along one day this way a bit, one day the other. But that's so far, that's two polls that have ALBA at about 3 or 4%. And one that's got it more at about the Sunday Times one at about 6 or 7%.
Yeah, which we identified, you know, and in certain regions would make sure that they actually got elected. I mean, to be perfectly honest, what I can't understand why ALBA is putting candidates up in areas which currently have, if they believe in the what they're saying that you vote in your constituency, why they're putting candidates up in areas which currently elect SNP listed MSPs. So that was a thing that occurred to me. Did it have any data on any potential impact of Galloway's mob, you know, George Galloway, the shapeshifter of Scottish politics?
Well, I think in this one, both the populist parties, as it were, failed to register particularly. And it seems that they go in tandem. You know, I think that was a characteristic of the last two polls as well, that when ALBA rises, Galloway rises. I'm not suggesting a causal link, people, but just that, you know, when people, well, it's strange. It seems to be when people start thinking about, as it were, how to use the list creatively, shall we say.
Yes.
That happens on both sides. But the sure as hell evidence that that it's happening is, as you mentioned, that Tory leaflet that came through the door keeps talking about, you know, they won't even lower themselves to calling it the list vote just so that everybody knows what you're on about. They're talking about your party vote, which, again, I think people will have to go, I don't know, which is my party vote? You know, it's like relabeling. So that's not how I think most people think of it. But anyway, fair play. So they're sort of saying, yeah, don't give it to this rabble. And they won't actually name George Galloway, but, you know, people that are kind of gaming the list on our side, essentially, it needs to be a Tory vote. So clearly these guys, you know, research the hell out of everything before they do these leaflets. So they're a very good indication of what's working and what's not. Douglas Ross ain't working. Ruth still kind of works. And the spectre of George Galloway is obviously worrying them deeply. So and of course, they're not even getting on to Alaba because they can't cross sides completely. But that must be worrying them as well. So it's who'd be Douglas Ross on a whole number of counts?
Yeah, well, he was it was on Call K as well. He was actually asked specifically by a guy who said, look, I'm a Conservative voter, but it's the Labour candidate in the constituency who has the better chance of, he's top of the votes last time. What would you advise me to do as someone who wants to stop the SNP? And Douglas Ross nearly said, well, vote Labour. Didn't quite. He said, but I would advise people to take a look at how you can defeat the independents, nationalists, and et cetera, et cetera.
Separatists, went, surely.
Separatists, He was going the full thing. And to say, the hook was it? He was talking about gaming the system. He was actually giving very specific instructions to Conservative voters how to game the system, first past the post. And this whole ruddy leaflet, by the way, they talk about the peach vote. The peach paper. It's peach paper. They're being very, you know, they're making it absolutely clear that, you know, I'm surprised they didn't have a little look, and this is the colour peach. But so they've got that there, and they're advising you to, they say, of course, yeah, the Conservatives are best placed in most areas to do this. So, you know, lend us your vote, even if it's just this one time. You know, we promise it'll just be the cars around the corner, the checks in the post. Just vote for us this one time. And they're going to be launching their manifesto on the 19th. Utterly irrelevant, to be perfectly frank. I thought Lorna Slater came out of it well in the debate, because that green lady. Oh God,
this is another thing for anybody that doesn't know. I mean, Pete Wishart referred to her in a tweet as, you know, that green, right? And I actually did a tweet back saying that green is called Lorna Slater, by the way.
Yeah.
Which got highly retweeted. And then Alex actually referred to her as the green lady or something, lady from the Greens. And I mean, I know it's a bit of a hoot, and people will think this is being overcritical, but the point is, you wouldn't walk into a debate with one huge bit of information missing like that from your head in any other respect than that it was a woman co-leader of a party.
Yeah.
So it just is the most incredible disrespect to be paid. And it just speaks volumes, because you don't sort of go, hey, thing me Ross, you know, unless, of course, you're calling them Murray and you're Boris Johnson. But, you know, that's picked on rightly as a kind of incredible indication of probably having no connection with them, anything. Yeah. Now, I'll grant you, Lorna, for many people, is new on the scene. But that's where, if you were in any other walk of life or any other aspect of politics, you'd go, yeah, I must make sure I remember Lorna Slater's name, because that's the one I'll forget. You'd have it written on the back of your hand just to make sure you didn't make a gaffe, you know. But to think that it's quite possible to put in a tweet, to not even bother to check on it when you're doing a tweet.
Yeah, but that's,
you know, it's like, what?
Yeah.
Anyway, so sorry. On you go.
No. I thought she made, I mean, and I have got I've got issues with the Greens on many things, but I find her increasingly impressive as a public speaker. But I mean, when I saw her on debate night, and again, she's a, if people don't know, she's an environmental engineer. She's involved in marine technologies and very new technology and green technologies. She knows it. She knows what she's talking about. I nearly used an American phrase that might have got us banned from Apple or have to put up explicit, but she knows her stuff. And I thought, held her own very, very well and articulated her argument. And You know, I think, and talking to people who watch that, who are not naturally inclined towards the Greens, are seriously now considering that as their list vote.
The thing that also impressed me, actually, in the debate was the quickness. I mean, when you're standing there in a TV studio, your brain, it's a real struggle to keep your brain focused on the thing in hand, because it is reeling a little bit from, you know, everything that's kind of happening around you, and the speed of everything and the muscular nature of everything, where there's just these pelters questioning, and of course from other leaders and so on. But she really kept her head, because while Douglas Ross was droning on about, you know, the transition fund in terms of energy that was going to somehow rescue Scotland from dependency on fossil fuels, Lorna just really leapt in and said, but the transition fund is only available for oil and gas companies. Mm. Bang. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, that absolutely stopped him in his tracks. He looked completely baffled for a minute, and then sort of just obviously was trying to decide, do I answer or do I not answer? And then thought, she's a marine engineer. And then, I'm not sure if I know what this fund's about anymore. And actually, she's right.
Yeah.
So he just kept going as if she hadn't said anything. But it was the perfect, because from there on in, you're hearing him framed by that little intervention from her, which was he is now lying from here on in, right? You know, which was a really skillful little intervention. The thing that there is, though, is that, you know, nobody is raising the gender recognition stuff in these debates. I'm not suggesting whether they should or shouldn't, but it is a factor that has caused considerable churn. I mean, it caused a lot of problems for the Greens. It's the reason that Andy Whiteman left. There were some very strong words said, in fact, by Lorna, who said that nobody would miss Andy, that he was sort of a nobody. You know, so that there's another side to a lot of this, which has not been aired, because it's almost as if the broadcasters themselves don't want to get into gender identity issues, because it can get pretty heated. Or why? I don't know. It feels perhaps like it's not, you know, it's not the main core issue that any party is putting up. So it's not being discussed, despite the fact it's what caused huge realignment. It was surprisingly, perhaps, the biggest single issue of causing political realignment before ALBA started. And in fact, sits behind much of ALBA's offer. So I don't know whether that will kick in later if ALBA decide, when they finally get to policy and women's rights is going to be one of the four, as I remember now, that they'll be discussing at their policy conference. So, but then, of course, the media isn't really jumping to ALBA's tune. You know, they're not being in the debates. Alex Salmon will be questioned as one of the leaders in a series of interviews that STV's redoubtable political editor Colin Mackay is doing. So he'll be included. George Galloway winner. They cite Ofcom regulations in that one. I'm not quite sure how they, you know, balance that out, but still. So he's got an opportunity there to go on that issue if he wants to go on it. But actually, it's not in the interest of any of the other parties to open this up. And I don't think their opponents seem very confident to kind of open it up either. So that sits behind an awful lot of stuff in a funny kind of way. It's weird that this has been so much of a huge issue in Scottish politics right up till now. And then at the moment of an election, it was completely
stum. Yeah.
And yet it is.
Yeah. And the others in it, I thought, I mean, Anna Sarwar, I mean, I've got no real time for him, but very articulate, very different proposition to Richard Leonard, both ideologically, I think, and in terms of his presentation, and did land the knockout blow, I think, on Douglas Ross as well, which was grow up. I thought it was when Ross came out with this whole thing, we're not prepared to work with anybody, and he doubled down on that again today in terms of climate change. He absolutely refused to work with a nationalist, separatist set of political parties to tackle climate change in the Holyrood Parliament. Absolutely doubled down on it. And I thought Anna Sarwar, I don't think Richard Leder could have done that and could have done it so well. So congratulations to Anna Sarwar on that. I've got their leaflet here that actually has some nice broad general statements, I mean, about intent. It's all very canny and couthy. The only thing that they forgot to do, actually, when they popped it through the door, I don't know if you're aware of this, if you've got this leaflet yet, Leslie, on the back of the leaflet it actually says, your local candidate, it says surname and name. And I was looking around for the coin to scratch that off to actually...
Is this Labour?
Yeah, to actually Labour to actually identify who the local Labour candidate is, and there's nothing on it to tell you. So they've put this all out, and we have to focus on uniting behind a national recovery plan. So they're going for this unification. It's all devised. I mean, he's very strong on that. He's very straightforward on that. There's no messing about with it. He's definitely a Keir Starmer man. He will go down very, very well with the establishment, the Labour Party. He will be a steadying influence, I think, on a diminishing Labour vote. I don't think, I just think he's going to be a better opposition spokesperson in Holyrood for the Labour Party. But the Labour Party, unfortunately, within the current constitutional setup, is a diminishing and a dying force that needs independence, I think, to rediscover its radical Scottish roots and become a genuine Scottish Labour Party. It looks at cooperativism and looks at, again, the massive changes that the socialist movement in Scotland, led by the Labour Party and the trade unions, was actually part of throughout the 20th century. However, they don't seem to buy into that.
But then that's another thing. You know, if you were to try to edge this even slightly onto, you know, trade union law, I think, is still a reserved issue at the behest of the Labour Party and the Smith Commission.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's without having to just be, there's a wee thing of trying to sort of be too brusque with Annas is difficult because he comes over as a very pleasant guy.
Yep.
He's new and he's also, you know, has the kind of privilege of being the first Muslim leader, I think, of any party in Britain, which is, it's great to see that diversity.
Yeah.
So it's funny, there's a sort of almost unspoken convention that you don't just kick somebody the second they're through the door, unless, of course, it's that green lady whose name you don't remember. But, you know, that's sort of working for him a bit as well. He's not like he sort of needs any special favours. He's been in Westminster, he's been in Holyrood, he's not a newbie. But in the same way as it's hit hard sometimes for some of these guys to take on female leaders without looking a bit thuggish. You know, Annas has got some space around him and he's started kind of well, partly by not going down that pathetic route that the Tories did, looking for votes of no confidence before Nicola Sturgeon had even given evidence in those inquiries. That was a good first call to not get sucked into that sort of nonsense. And he's got the capacity as well to slightly speak in that wider plane way I was talking earlier, because he was not just sort of kind of trying to dodge the question when it was that vote of no confidence thing. He actually said, I just think this is really unwise and we need to listen to the evidence and follow the process. Right. You know, I can remember that, those words. I don't remember what I did yesterday. So that's some going, you know, that he's managed to plant in your mind that he had an approach to that, you know, not just a sort of knee jerk thing and not a petty thing. So he's doing quite well in sort of setting all of that out. But then there's the thing. This will all work quite well. And it would be interesting, because what's happening too might well be that the sort of the unionist vote, which we had hitherto thought was attracted by whoever looked the toughest, and of course clambering onto a large army vehicle in a sort of slightly unfortunate way, sort of does not do a repeat of Ruth. It only accentuates how much you're not Ruth, really, when you do stuff like that. But I mean, this sort of just being as nasty as possible to people thing to prove just how hard you are, like, come on, if you think you're hard enough, unionism seems to be a bit, perhaps a bit in decline, perhaps only because it's embodied by somebody that many unionists are finding it very hard to warm to in the shape of Douglas Ross. But, you know, if it swings round a bit, it sort of becomes potentially, you know, I haven't heard Annas talk too much about the glories of the union. That will be the trouble for him, because, you know, then he's got to try and sell a cuddlier union if he's going to be trying to take votes from the Tories. So, you know, this too would be something that people like Nicola Sturgeon, should be trying to tease out a bit in these debates and be slightly more on the front foot about than she was the first time. Though, as many people will say, you know, she'd just come straight from doing all sorts of COVID-y stuff beforehand. She did seem a little sort of inert, you know. And you don't need to be nasty. It's just a straightforward question, you know, that these things, of course, that will only end up being a soundbite. Will you vote, you know, if there's an independence majority, will you back the case for having Section 30 powers? I mean, that's the nub question. But it would be worth asking just to hear how he actually tries to approach that. Will he try to sound as kind of, you know, there is a horrible smell in the room suddenly, you know, as... the way that the kind of Douglas Ross approach, I will not even breathe the same air as you people kind of outrage nonsense? Or will he try to sort of create a different sort of space for unionism? And if so, what will that be? I mean, I'd love to hear all this stuff. And I've got more confidence that there's a chance it'll come out in the STV debate because, I mean, OK, I am probably so biased now. It's probably like a reformed smoker or something. You know, I used to work for the BBC and then left. And I'm just really, really generally impressed by STV's ability to sort of think about formats, you know, because that's what delivers the a good programme. It's not just how aggressive you are towards people. It's how you stake out the game before it even begins. So I think they've got some cross-examination of one another built in, as well as some audience questions and some, you know, strong leadership from the presenter. So all of that is there. And then, of course, there's these this series of leaders' individual interviews, which reminds me of old Brian Walden. God, that's showing my age, eh?
But bring back, well, would be could resurrect Brian Walden.
But again, that's a format. You know, if you had a format, you'd get a new Brian Walden.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, bats love belfries. Create belfries, you'll get bats, you know. It's that nobody is doing the format of a big sort of really long, apart from Andrew Neil.
Yeah.
Which is another little poison chalice that I hope Alex Salmond will resist, you know, because there's the possibility of, you know, giant haystacks versus Big Daddy, you know, if you kind of get into that one. I mean, you'll definitely get the ratings, but do not go there, I hope.
Yeah, just to explain to people that the new channel are mooting the idea they'll get George Galloway and Alex Salmond on to debate each other.
This is Andrew Neil's new channel. Is it?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Whoever it is now, this new lot that are
Spectator.
Some right wing, non Murdoch outfit pumping money into the to this new Gammon TV that they've established. So and turning to one of our friends, Mr. Rennie. And, you know, if my name was Willie, I wouldn't be posing against giant deck chairs and giant chess pieces, because that just allows people to refer to him as Wee Willie Rennie. But that's just me. But he did come up with an interesting concept. He seems to have rediscovered his support for a fairer method of proportional representation, Leslie, which is single transferable vote.
Yes, you know, this is his kind of, and various other things, which are basically like somebody, you know, sort of going into a, well, I've got a shed like this that's basically falling down, and I've got a tarpaulin on the top of it, which is held down by various bungees, which are attached to a decking piece with a stone on top to stop it flapping around in the wind. It would just be simpler to have an independent country, Willie, and then you could actually start again and have a proper system, you know, just like the shed I will one day get around to actually building when that one's blown away. But yeah, he's got all sorts of, you know, bits to try and sort of shore up the system that we've currently got, including a move to full single transferable vote, which some people oppose because it would lose the constituency link. We've been through this before, but you know, the thing when you look at this was obviously a response to this gaming of the system lark, which accusations which are now, you know, people have now been alert to the fact that there is, you know, methods within the system and possibilities. So Willie's going around trying to bang shut all the, you know, possible other entrants to that system, given that actually the Lib Dems, you know, also win stuff on the list, although they do win first past the post as well. So, I mean, everybody's gainers, particularly the unionist parties, actually really, really gain from the list, which is, you know, the bit that that was going to be the consolation prize for the also-rans, as they saw it initially, which was obviously going to be the nationalist kind of parties and the SNP in particular. my, how the boot, you know, changes to the other foot. So anyway, nonetheless, you can still have a good idea, even if it comes from a not terribly sort of noble place. The thing that struck me about it, though, and I did a wee video for the National on this, was to me, this is the ultimate backhanded compliment to the different distinct politics Scotland possesses, because there is not a chance in hell that single transferable vote will ever be implemented by Westminster for its elections. I mean, I think I would put safely a bet on saying not in my lifetime, because whoever wins in Westminster just pulls the drawbridge up on that totally unfair system because it got them elected and does not look to try to fix, you know, the sort of roof while the sun's shining. The only place that you might actually have a reasonable argument about fairness in a voting system is Scotland, because it's not just kind of the SNP as a party, which has got a different outlook than the general sort of consensus south of the border. And this is a really key point, which I think a lot of independent supporters miss, because we just didn't want to say anything good about the other parties, right? But it's really significant that Scottish Labour have been able to do and think differently and act differently, yep, in the Scottish dimension. So they were able to bring in personal care here, not in a month of Sundays down the road. Jack McConnell changed and put STV into local elections here. It's never happened. Local elections still first past the post down the road, even under a Labour government. So, you know, the things that can be done here and have been done by other political parties, the Fresh Talent Initiative that Jack McConnell also brought in, which was trying to change immigration policy using the small powers that Scotland had to create a different outcome, backed by every party, including the Tories, right? So that is, you know, if we're going to come back to the idea that that Alex Salmond's tossed into the public domain now, which is he's saying that the supermajority means that it's a parliament that Boris is ignoring, not just a party, not just one party, mm-hmm, the SNP, but a parliamentary majority, then it's also the case that that parliament has actually got a different mindset, not just one corner of it. The whole parliament has got a different mindset. And sometimes, because we end up with the rivalry that necessarily arises in election time, we overlook the fact that it's very significant when, you know, to go back to that earlier analogy, when the folk at the back of the tent are actually moving quicker than any other tent on the field, that's fast.
Yeah.
It may be relatively slow within your wee kind of posse, but they're still moving. The rest are going backwards. And that's a really significant thing, again, just to go back to the old Nordics. It was conservatives within Norway and Finland who created the really progressive cities that are Oslo and Helsinki. They've been under conservative control locally for 20 or 30 years. And have created the huge changes to make them Helsinki registered as Europe's best city to live in. So a kind of Nordic Tory is way ahead of potentially a Scottish Labour Party person at the moment. So within our posse, we have got a progressive posse. And I know some people will go spit bang no, you know, we're not going to say anything. And okay, I might just take Douglas Ross out. I think that. Yeah. Actually might be why he's having such trouble, because he's adrift. You know, mm-hmm, he's adrift from that sort of almost kind of consensus. He's trying, absolutely, to be adrift because he thinks that's the way he'll get votes. And I suspect that actually most Scottish voters are happier with their consensus than having to support someone who basically disses it.
Yeah.
That's my thought.
Oh, sorry. I thought I'd lost you there. And
I do stop sometimes, Pat.
Well, no. That's and I was waiting to say on that shock announcement that Leslie stops sometimes. But I'm going to say something else. So I think that's absolutely spot on, Leslie. That's something I genuinely, I don't know, folk out there are thinking, something I hadn't considered before. He does step out with that. And got to remember the fact that consensus, you've got to remember the fact it was a coalition Labour Liberal Democrat government that we actually had up here in Scotland. So the Lib Dems were on board with that. But that general consensus that we can see over innumerable matters over the time period of the Scottish Parliament is there. It is a left of centre progressive consensus that if only we could get beyond the constitutional issue, we could actually start tackling these endemic problems and create a different and better Scotland. But anyway, this morning, after we finish this, I've got to do all the editing, and then I'm going to switch into watching golf mode. I know you'll be keen to do this as well, Leslie. There's Robert McIntyre from Oban, a self-declared chuchter who went down Magnolia Drive to the Masters in Augusta to an accordion band, is playing there. A left-handed shinty player from Oban, Robert McIntyre, great young lad. He's playing there. I think there are another two or three Scots that have qualified for the Masters as well, or have been invited to the Masters as well. And it takes place in Georgia. And people may remember Georgia was the state that swung the election fundamentally for Joe Biden on a tiny minority of votes, which were garnered by Stacey Abrams, who had been an unsuccessful candidate for the governorship in Georgia, where the guy who won had actually wiped about 1.5 million votes off the register. And Georgia has been enacting all these changes in voting regulations, which are specifically designed in terms of voter ID and making it a criminal offence, for example, because you have lengthy queues to hand out water or food to someone standing in a queue to vote, a criminal offence, folks. They're changing all these votes. And Augusta, the Masters, I think one of the finest golf tournaments in the world, beautiful course, takes place in the heart of Georgia, only about a mile away from Sandy Hill, which is the ghetto, the African-American ghetto, from which all the caddies originally, who caddied at the Masters up until the 1980s, who were all African-American, and were the heroes and the forgotten heroes of the National. And another guy, Lee Elder, who was the first African-American to actually play and be invited to play in the Masters, is going to be one of the honorary starters. He played in 1975, I think it was, and he was subjected to death threats. He had to have two houses. He had to flip between. So the local KKK, etc., didn't know where he lived because he was under death threats. But he played in 1975, and the actual golf club didn't allow African-Americans or people of any colour to join until 1990, when they were told by the PGA, of Professional Golf Association of America, who themselves operated a colour bar, by the way, up until 1961. So Lee Elder, who became won a lot on the PGA Tour eventually, he played in the US Golf, the United Golf Association, which was the African-American golfers. So when you watch the Masters, folks, you won't see many African-Americans out there. There used to be, all the caddies used to be African-American, but in the 1980s it changed to allow them to bring their own caddies into play. When you think about it, it does exist in that state where that's going on. It lives cheek by jowl with the African-American neighborhood, just if Sandy Hill, just a mile away. And please remember Lee Elder, the honorary starter who will be starting with Jack Nicklaus. And Lee Elder was a pioneer, a man who suffered death threats and didn't actually play a proper round of golf till he joined the army in about 1959 when he was 18, and he was mentored by his colonel in his regiment to become a professional golfer, and had to overcome all that adversity towards him. So remember Lee Elder this morning as he tees off, and keep your fingers crossed for Robert McIntyre.
Wow, I didn't know any of that. that is fascinating. And I wonder if it is this proud, you know, did you notice that Andy Murray was talking about, should he actually have to quit tennis?
Yes.
He was talking about potentially becoming a caddy.
Oh, it's. I actually considered that when I packed in college, because you can become a caddy at St Andrews, and trust me on that. That's a great job to have. I mean, but I didn't. So I mean, and I think even now, just with my hay fever, I might actually struggle to actually carry a bag for 18 holes around. And I do remember one of the great caddy stories was that an American was teeing off at St Andrews, and he absolutely hooked it, you know what I mean? And you've got to play really badly to to knock it out of bounds. And the American said to his carry, yeah, I'm going to take a mulligan, which is, you know, you get a free shot, you're free go, and it doesn't count. I'm going to take a mulligan here. What do you call that in Scotland? To which the carry replied, three off the tee, sir. And move on. But yeah, if you're watching it, as I say, keep your fingers crossed for Robert McIntyre. And on that patriotic note, we'll see you next week, chaps.